I'm Lindsay Claiborne.
And I'm Mumu Shu, and you are listening to Beyond the Microscope. Okay, guys, with us today is Shannon Mahaley, who is a missions operations engineer for NASA at JPL. Shannon, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself, what you do, who you are, where you came from, all that good stuff.
Everything, and your social security number, phone number, address,
credit card
number.
Of course, all the vital information. All right, well, thanks for talking with me, and I'm excited to, I guess, share a bit more about what I do. So let's see. So what do I do? I guess right now I kind of hold a lot of different positions within the project I work on. And that project is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, or MRO for short, as we like to go by acronyms at NASA to keep things a little more succinct. And so I'm a mission operations engineer, but I do a lot of different tasks. And one of those tasks is that I'm a science planner. And what that means is basically we plan science observations along a timeline for a period of time and then send that information up to the spacecraft. And then the spacecraft can execute those observations in that time order for, you know, the given period of time that you determine.
So it's like a giant calendar you send to it. Say, do this, that, now, and then do this, and then do this.
Yeah, basically it's a list of observations. And so you just kind of send it, you know, the information of what points on the surface you want to observe. And then separately from that list, or that, you know, separate from
the instructions.
Yeah, separate from that list of instructions, you basically send up, instruments send up their individual commands specifically for those observations.
Okay.
So we do that kind of as a separate fashion. The instrument teams that have instruments on board the orbiter send up their commands separately from the list or the plan that we integrate.
I was going to ask a background information about how you got interested in space and how you ended up where you are.
So I've always had a fascination with space exploration, as long as I can remember, you know, back to, gosh, the age of 4 or 5, probably. Around that age, I remember, you know, starting to read about all the planets, and I would go to the museum, go to various events for, you know, solar eclipses, or just to go to the planetarium or various exhibits that were at the museum. I would watch TV shows, you know, that had to do with space. So Star Trek is one that, you know, comes into mind. Documentaries, not necessarily a Trekkie, but
oh, we've been found out.
I know, right? But you know, anything that had to do with space. And so, you know, even in middle school, I would I don't think they necessarily do that anymore, but they used to host chats with NASA employees. So sometimes during recess, I would stay inside and participate in these chats with NASA employees
during middle school.
Oh
my gosh, that's adorable.
So it goes way back.
If only you could be that person now and chatting with the next generation.
I know, yeah. Right? So it was a good opportunity, and it really inspired me to try to work towards that career. And I think there's even a recording of me somewhere saying that I wanted to be a mission controller when I was 13 years old. So So we've sort of come full circle, and now I get to do that sort of stuff. So,
is it everything you dreamed it to be?
It is. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, on a day-to-day basis, you tend to forget you're working on a spacecraft that's orbiting Mars. But, you know, when you sit and really take a step back and think about it, it's kind of amazing that we've been able to put so many spacecraft on the surface and in orbit, and we've, you know, been able to really expand our knowledge about the planet so much, even within the past decade, that, you know, facts and information that we never knew before.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about sort of the science planning or scheduling. So when you send a command up into space, what actually happens?
As a science planner, what we do is we have 6 different instruments on board the spacecraft, on board MRO. And those 6 instruments do everything from taking high-resolution images to giving us sort of a context of where those high-resolution images are. We have an instrument that looks at the weather and tells us a daily weather report. We have an instrument that looks at the mineralogy on the surface to better inform us of, you know, what minerals are in certain locations. And that can also help us eventually with picking landing sites for rovers and on-the-ground investigations. We have an instrument that looks below the surface. It's a radar instrument to look for liquid or frozen water within the first few hundreds of feet, even up to actually a kilometer below the surface. And so with those instruments, they all send in their observation requests to the science planner. We also get requests from the rovers and the landers for relay support. So we also support the Mars Exploration or MER rover, the Opportunity rover, and we support the Curiosity rover. And so we get all those products. We integrate them into a two-week plan. So once we get that two-week plan, we actually end up chopping it up into one-week sections. And then in the following 2 weeks, we plan each of those one-week sections by piling some more observations on top of those one-week skeleton plans. And so we basically uplink one-week plans of observations at a time. We have a one-week plan. And so it takes about four and a half weeks to plan these 2 weeks of observations. We call the 2 weeks a cycle, if that makes sense.
How far ahead are you? I mean, I know you said it takes 4.5 weeks, but I mean, would you be working on a plan for 4 weeks from now, or would you be working on a plan for 6 months from now? I mean, how far in advance are you sort of working through these things?
Yeah, so we just plan cycle by cycle. So you're basically starting, 4 weeks for a 2 week plan. So yeah, about 4 weeks before those first observations are executing. And so we don't plan on a day-to-day turnaround time frame like the rovers do, for example. You know, we make a plan, we send it up, you know, the observations get executed, and then you have to get that data back down, inspect that data, and then decide if you want to follow up with an image. So it may take you a few additional weeks to get a follow-up image on board, and then, you know, another few weeks to get that data back down. So the turnaround time is not as quick as something on the surface, but we're able to cover a lot more ground. Obviously being, you know, as an orbiter.
Well, is there, that sounds like it could be stressful. I mean, do you have like a hard deadline? You have to get your plan up, or is it whenever we decide to send it to the orbiter, that's fine?
We have a deadline. Basically, our week plans go from Saturday to Saturday at midnight. So, we have a designated, you know, uplink windows to get those plans up to the spacecraft. And so usually we uplink those on Friday, no later than Friday. Or sometimes if, you know, we really need to do something, sometimes we push it into Saturday. But usually it's actually on board on Friday.
In time for happy hour.
Yes, there you go.
Happy hour for the orbiter or for you guys? That's the real question.
For everybody.
For everyone. But you're not on Mars time, are you?
No. So usually Mars time is reserved for missions that are early on, in their mission. So early on the surface, while they're doing a lot of their checkouts and making sure that the instruments all survived. Usually it's done when you're landing a landed asset. So something like a rover or a lander. Okay.
And just for people who don't know, can you explain a little bit about what Mars time is?
So Mars time, the difference between Earth and Mars, Mars has a bit of a longer day than Earth. Going to look up the specific time frame. I know, I forget the exact difference.
See, this is the proof of a real scientist or engineer is you have to make sure you're right and not
there
just,
you go, you
know,
exactly.
Remember
spewing
it correctly.
Information. So basically Mars has an extra 37 minutes on their day or on their sol. SOL, that is the name for a Mars day, the sol. And so because of that difference in time, you can imagine you're planning your normal day, your normal shift of when, you know, Mars is in its daytime, for example, when you can, you know, rove and take pictures and things like that, that shifts relative to Earth time. So what ends up happening is that when rovers or landers get to the surface, a lot of times NASA will have their staff be on Mars time. And basically that means you just have a continuous operation rotation of shifts, where you're rotating the start of your day relative to when that time would start on Mars. So 8 a.m. on Mars may be, you know, a different time on Earth as you progress through the weeks. So what that ends up doing is, you know, you end up getting people working into the night. And so it creates a very interesting schedule where, you know, people are working during the night and sleeping during the day. So it's this really intensive time period where, you know, people don't see the light of day for a long time. And so it can really mess with your body. And so it's, I've never personally been on it, but I know that people, there are such thing as Mars time watches, and just to make sure that, you know, people are aware of what time is really, you know.
Where are they?
What yeah, time exactly.
Is it? What time? What day is it?
Exactly.
Does that mean there's a setting on my iPhone that I could switch to Mars time?
Maybe.
That'd be great.
There's an app to make right there.
There's probably an app out there for that.
So what is sort of working on all these things and being sort of the sort of center point of organizing all this stuff, what's the most exciting part to it for you? What is it that sort of gets you excited?
I think what's neat is working with all the different science teams and working with the engineering team too. So it's sort of the intersection of engineering and science, and you really have to make sure that you're respecting the desires and the goals of the science teams while also respecting the engineering constraints. And so, you know, we have a bunch of rules that we check, and those are rules for spacecraft and instrument health and safety to make sure that, you know, none of the science observations are doing anything that's going to damage or harm the spacecraft or any of the instruments. And so you need to make sure that you're observing that and respecting that at the same time as you're, you know, obtaining and achieving those science goals. And so I really enjoy, you know, doing this and seeing the results of these science efforts. And, you know, though I don't necessarily a lot of the times know what observations are going up when I'm doing the planning, you know, we have a rough idea, but you don't inspect all 1,000 and some observations that are going up in a given week. And it's neat to eventually see the science that comes back and see the scientists interpret the data and talk about the findings. And it's just, it's great when you've done something that's never been done before and you've been a part of that process.
And you get to see, go, ooh, I had it do that. I know that one.
Yeah.
Well, we were actually talking before about the difference between engineers and scientists. And Mumu was sort of chuckling about that. But
I was trying to explain. The difference.
Some of us don't think there's much of a difference. And she was saying sort of the same thing. I mean, do you sometimes have to sort of translate between groups?
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, people's backgrounds and what they're used to dealing with on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, scientists are very used to looking at their specific data set and their science. And even between different science groups, sometimes you have to translate. And, you know, the engineers are used to looking at certain components on the engineering side. So looking at the propulsion, looking at the thermal properties, you know, making sure that we are a healthy spacecraft. And so when you're looking at those specific details day to day, sometimes you have to take a step back and really listen to the other side. And so that's kind of where we come in as science planners and science systems engineers, trying to discuss both sides and make sure that everyone understands the details and can look at it, you know, look at the details, but also take a step back and look at the bigger picture.
Shannon, I remember you had you had on your away message a while ago something about units of measure of will I ams.
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell the story about that? But somehow I need to ask a question that leads up to that.
So at some point...
You don't have to ask a question that leads up to that.
We can just ask... Okay.
This is just JPL and it's... JPL is cool, people.
There you go. So at some point, early on in the Curiosity mission, there was a Will.i.am song. I think it was called Reach for the Stars. I'm not sure if that's what it's called, but something along those lines. And we sent it to the rover. So MRO sent the song to the rover, MSL. And MSL, in turn, then sent it back. And so it was the first song that was played back from Mars, quote unquote. And so, you know, you can think about data return in terms of number of songs that we've sent. So overall, MRO as a mission has returned about 250 terabits of data. And what that translates to is about 10 million Will.i.am songs. So it's 10 million, like 3 megabyte MP3 songs is how much data we've transferred over the course of the mission. And another way to think about it is we've also, you can think about it in terms of digital pictures. If your digital picture is 5 megabytes in size, we've sent back 6 million digital pictures over the course of our 9-year mission. So it's quite a bit.
Does Will.i.am know that you have a unit of measure for him?
I don't know.
We may have to tell him. Does anybody know him? Can we call him?
I'm sure.
Tweet at him.
There you go.
Yeah. I'll just call it Fergie right now and have her relay the message.
Oh, yes. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure. So what, your background is in geoscience, right, Shannon?
So I did my bachelor's in aerospace engineering. And, you know, I thought that would be the best way to sort of understand the fundamentals of space exploration. And while studying aerospace engineering, I had an internship at NASA Goddard where I worked on one of the instruments that's on the Curiosity rover. And I did a lot of science experiments for them, establishing baseline temperatures for their instrument and then testing some standards that they can compare to. You know, once they're on the surface of, or they're on the surface of Mars, they could compare to those standards that we tested. And so kind of that experience led me to want to pursue science in graduate school. So I studied geosciences, specifically geomicrobiology or astrobiology in graduate school. So I kind of have a blended background, which...
Is that common? I mean, I know a lot of, I mean, obviously people come from all different backgrounds to be at JPL, but are you a sort of in a unique position to have a double background like that?
I think there's more and more people doing that. I've met quite a few people at JPL who seem to have a wide array of experiences and backgrounds, you know, sort of a blended science engineering or, you know, science and business or, you know, science communication. So there's a lot of different backgrounds, and I think that's what makes the blended background is helpful when you're working on a mission with such diverse instruments and such diverse capabilities, if that makes any sense.
What's your sort of take on privatized space?
So personally, I think the private push to go to space is good. I think that any avenue in which we can explore space is good. And we, you know, there's still rules and regulations that, you know, all the private space companies should respect. But, you know, as long as people are exploring and pushing each other, I think that, you know, competition is healthy. So hopefully that'll lead to new technology and new innovation and new findings, you know, even though a lot of this is done for purely, a lot is done for, I think, you know, in the future, the thought is maybe some commercial gain, but, you know, if we can also integrate science into that commercial, you know, business aspect of space exploration, that would also be very good. But, you know, and there's also the privatization in terms of NASA going out to companies like SpaceX and Boeing and looking for private companies to develop spacecraft. And in a sense, NASA's, you know, been doing that for a while, maybe not in the human side, but You know, NASA does do that in terms of spacecraft building and instrument design. I mean, on the mission I work on, for example, Lockheed built the spacecraft. And so, you know, it's not necessarily anything completely new that we've gone to private companies to do this. We do a lot of in-house work as well at NASA, where we build our own spacecraft, but there is a lot of private companies involved already. So I think that involving private companies on the human side, you know, can only be good as well.
Well, we just talk about it now, right? Because everybody wants to go to space. You've got, you know, Virgin Galactic, like, let's take random people or, you know, average citizens up into space.
Right.
And the Mars colony, I don't even know what it's called, where they're planning on sending people.
Or like they're faking it. They're doing the sample of what it would be like living out in desert here or something like that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, for things like that, for specifically talking about going to Mars, you know, there's certain things I think we need to do on the robotic side to make sure that we don't destroy the environment with humans. I mean, humans tend to bring a lot of bugs, microbes, everywhere they go. So, you know, we also have to make sure we somehow protect the environment. So we're not destroying it and destroying evidence of, you know, compounds that, you know, there show evidence that there may once have been life, or if there is life on Mars, that we, you know, don't somehow contaminate that or give a false positive by bringing something from Earth. So, you know, in terms of human missions, we just, there needs to be some sort of respective regulations, and we just need to make sure we keep science also as a consideration.
Well, I mean, they always talk about, you know, things that have been, that get developed in the quest for the sort of splashy, shiny goal, right? Like getting humans to Mars, but along the way you have to develop all this technology to get there.
Right.
Is it faster when it's like done through the private sector, or is it just sort of who cares who's working on it? It's just, it'll get there.
Well, I'm trying to think
of it. No, it's okay. There may not be an answer to that.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that private companies have a different way of inspiring people and generating funds. You know, when you're relying on the government, you're relying on the budget. And sometimes the money isn't there for a big scale endeavor such as going to Mars. I mean, right now,
you got like Elon Musk saying, here's $1 million, do something.
Right, exactly. Yeah, when you have, yeah.
He can take more risk though, right? He can sort of say, screw it, I've got the money. Let's just do it. If it fails, then we'll try again.
Right, yeah. NASA has a higher risk aversion, you know, aversion to risk than private companies sometimes do.
Understandably.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense.
So, you know, yeah, if you can tolerate a little more risk and potentially generate the funds for that, then I think, you know, private companies can definitely advance. Maybe faster than government can, but I don't know. We'll have to see. I know that, you know, some of the companies are well on their way. SpaceX has done a lot to prove that they are, you know, gearing to send humans up into space. And, you know, maybe they'll be able to take that to Mars before the government is able to do so.
Would you ever consider moving to Mars?
Personally,
not like living on Mars, just moving. It's like, you know, hiring a moving company, no big deal.
Just visiting.
You ship your car.
Personally, I want to keep my feet on the ground. But I think, you know, at some point in our lives, it would be great to see humans on there, on the surface. It would be great if we could bring those humans back so they could share their stories with people on Earth. So, you know, that would be a good goal to achieve, you know, not only getting them there, but then also bringing them back. So it's not just a one-way trip. But that is a huge technological challenge. And we'll see what happens in the next 20 year, you know, 30, 40 years down the line with that.
Hopefully we'll all still be here to see what happens.
Yes.
On that. Do you have sort of like something that really is, you get excited about some new technology or some new project or something that's ongoing, whether it's at JPL or elsewhere, that sort of, you know, makes you excited or that you're looking forward to?
Some of the most exciting things, some of the most exciting concepts that currently are in work are the Mars 2020 rover, for example. So it's the follow-on to the Curiosity rover with a lot of new payload on board. So the goal of that rover is specifically to look for organic biomarker, organic molecules or biomarkers. And the hope also with that rover is that it should, you know, would be able to put samples into a cache so we can potentially go back in the future and retrieve those samples and bring them back to Earth. And so we've, you know, never done that outside of the moon, you know, obtaining samples and bringing them back. And we do have, you know, pieces of Mars from collisions with Mars sending, you know, meteorites raining down on Earth, but we don't have any actual samples from the surface that we've ever, you know, been able to bring back. So I think that would be a huge technological feat and would enable us to do a lot more science on those samples than we can do with a rover or a lander. And so, you know, that would be a big step in science and our technology abilities. You know, there's also talk about a mission to Europa and, you know, looking at what could be under the surface of Europa. And there's the potential for an ocean to actually exist.
So let's say we were to bring back a sample from Mars. Is there a possibility that in that sample is some weird bacteria or virus or something that could kill off the human species?
You're all over these like sci-fi, we're all going to kill you things.
I'm on a weird kick right now.
So I think, you know, I don't know this for sure, but there would definitely be precautions taken to ensure that there would not be anything that got out and created, you know, mass destruction. So I'm sure that there would be facilities that would be built, you know, clean facilities, clean rooms, labs dedicated solely to these samples, for processing these samples. And, you know, the likelihood of anything actually surviving Mars in itself, you know, life as we know it's a very harsh environment. So for life as we know it to exist and be on the surface as of now would be incredible. And so, you know, with also just leaving the samples on the surface for an extended period of time until we'd be able to go back, they'd be exposed to a lot of radiation, which would potentially further, you know, damage or harm any life that would be in existence. Then it has to travel all the way through the environment of space back to Earth. And, you know, that's not including anything that we might do to the sample when it's collected, such as, you know, potentially heating it to destroy any signs of life. So the chance of actually getting something living all the way back to Earth is a very low probability. But, you know, the evidence of life could be seen in those samples. We might not, you know, actually bring back the life itself in a living form.
We're going to quote you on that so that when the Mars virus takes over the planet, we'll say, but you said it was safe.
I know, that's right.
I saw Contagion. Still got my doubts, but okay.
Is it sort of neat working in this field? I mean, you said before that you sort of forget, you know, you're talking to your colleagues and you're like, oh yeah, well, when I was controlling the Mars orbiter and I did the... I mean, is it sort of weird to step outside of that and talk to non-space people?
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, on a day-to-day basis, it seems you're just kind of doing the tasks that you would normally do. You know, you're planning things, you're answering emails, you're going to meetings, you know. But then when you're in those meetings and someone says, oh, hey, I'd really like to observe this feature on the surface of Mars, you know, because it's the season for it, the lighting's right, you know, it kind of brings you back and, you know, you get to see things that you would never think would exist on Mars. You know, we've found out recently that Mars has weather. It's a very dynamic planet. You know, there's clouds. The ice caps change with season. There are avalanches that occur on the surface. It's constantly being bombarded by by particles. So we see evidence of ice underneath the surface when it gets bombarded and craters form. So it is a very exciting planet to study. And so when you're, you know, in a meeting where you see these results, and even when you're sitting and doing some planning, sometimes you'll see an observation pop up that says, you know, seasonal inspection of a dune, you know, or if you're looking at observations and one pops up and says that it's targeting a future landing site, you know, you're helping out. MRO does a lot to support future landing site campaigns. So we're looking at possible regions of interest for landing sites for not only the next rover, so Mars 2020, but also the ExoMars rover that's planning to launch in 2018. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. And so sometimes you just have to take a step back and listen to the science and look at the bigger picture. And that's when it really hits you, I think, that you're working on another planet.
So working on Mars and some of these projects and orbiters and rovers, obviously you can get really attached to these things. And of course, you know, you said earlier that your love of science has always been around and you've always wanted to do this. When the Mars Curiosity rover landed, there was a video out about how the landing was this whole new experimental thing to do, and it was going to be several minutes of terror, and nobody knew if it was going to work, and everybody's put all these years into it. And we understand that you have a pretty funny story about the day that the Mars rover actually landed. It was a relatively important day for you in your life.
So, I was married on the day after it landed. So in planning our wedding, we sort of forgot, I guess, about that one important day. And it was the only time that the venue was available. So that's when we got married. So the night of the landing, we were, you know, not together, separate, and watching the landing take place. And I was very relieved to know that my colleagues and probably myself too, in some sense, would have a job when I went back, because so I didn't have to go into my, you know, wedding all sad or anything. it was a relief.
How did you talk yourself into, because I don't know, for me, I probably would have been, don't tell me anything until the wedding is over.
Well, you can't not know. I mean, come on.
These
people who work at like JPL that are at your wedding, everybody, I mean, it's like, hold on, can we put a time out? We just have to watch this land, and then we can go back to the festivities.
Yeah, it happened at 11 o'clock at night, the night before, so I couldn't really go to sleep without finding out. It was, I was very anxious. So, yeah, I made sure that I watched, and I knew what the results were, and...
and everything was happily ever after. See?
Exactly, there you go.
That's all I've got, Shannon. I appreciate you, revealing those secret moments of the night before your wedding.
No problem.
Thanks for joining us. I hope you had fun and we didn't torture you too much.
No, hopefully what I said makes sense. Thanks for...
I don't think that was the problem, whether we made any sense.
Oh, yeah. Well,
thanks for having me, and it's always great to talk about, you know, what you do and take a step back and realize what you're working on and look at it, you know, from a different angle.
Like our show? Find us on iTunes or at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Mumu Shu
and Lindsay Claiborne.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycats. Thanks for listening.